Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
When we talk about science and religion, it sounds like two things, but my guest today says that's changing. Greg Cuzzona has a PhD from Berkeley's Graduate Theological Union. And in 2014, he began teaching at Chico State with a science and religion course. Teaching in the Department of Comparative Religion and Humanities affords him the opportunity to engage in ideas through a variety of disciplines, such as philosophy, religion, and literature. His previous books include Say Yes to No and Mere Science and Christian Faith. His latest book is Negotiating Science and Religion in America, Past, Present, and Future. Greg Cuzzona, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Now, I mentioned that you have this opportunity to talk to, on a various subjects, to your students.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a label that we use now for this age group, this demographic, which was not in vogue when you were in that age group.
That's
what is
right.
That?
Emerging adults. So for 18 to 30-year-olds, Jeffrey Arnett, a psychologist, came up with this concept of emerging adults in the year 2000 to describe the way in which people, basically in their 20s, we'll say, are not hitting all the marks that have been the traditional five markers of adulthood, especially getting married and having children. Those two things are being delayed much longer. So it puts people in this category, 18 to 30, in much more of a transitional kind of phase, working out values, working out where they're going to live, working out what they're going to do, even their work. And so that provides a different kind of experience in your 20s, probably than you and I have had, just a few years ago, shall we say.
Well, in fact, I wanted to ask you about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
How would you compare your time period in your life when you were what we would call now an emerging adult versus the students that you see now?
Well, I think one of the things that my wife Laura and I went through is just to figure out how many of these, quote, five markers, you know, had we satisfied. I don't want to think of these as things you have to do in order to be a full human or even a full adult, but things that define adulthood sociologically. That's really the category we're looking at. And, you know, for us, I think that key element of finding who you're going to love was early in my life and probably earlier than a lot of people. I married at age 22. And so, you know, that was, again, younger than most of my friends. Today, the average age for a man in the United States is somewhere around 28. So that keeps getting pushed back for different reasons we could talk about sociologically. And then the other thing was, what are you going to do? So who are you going to love and what are you going to do? What's your work? And right after college, with my literary degree in hand, Laura and I decided to open up a small business in partnership with my family and so on. And so we had a pretty early experience of having a job. It didn't end up being the work we were going to do forever, but it did at that time satisfy that. In comparison to people today, I see a lot more transition in terms of what a 20-something is going to do for their work. It's just a deep sense of, I'm not sure that this job is going to be something I'm going to have for decades from now. And also, I think companies are putting people into the gig economy, which means people have to be flexible. People don't think that what they're going to be doing today, even in terms of the kind of work they're about, they'll be doing, you know, even 20 years from now. So I think those things were present, meaning that those transitional elements were present when I was going through this in the sort of late 80s, early 90s. But I think it's accelerated at a rapid clip in the last, 30 years or so.
My guest is Greg Cuzzona, and he teaches emerging adults at Chico State University. One difference, I think, Greg, because a lot of what you're saying when you went through at that time was similar to mine, but I think there's one difference, and that is when I was growing up, I attended the Methodist Church, and that was fine. I get to college, and I think, wait a minute, I don't think I believe all that stuff. It was just handed to me, say, here, believe this, and I don't think I do.
Yes.
Now, was your experience anything like that?
Well, I think that would be true for for many people in my, you know, age group. So I was going through these, you know, the 20s in the 80s and early 90s. And a lot of people would have a religious tradition to which they are affiliated. And, you know, for most people in the United States, that's Christianity. For me, growing up in the Bay Area, it's almost always, I should say, indicated as the place of the lowest religious identification in the United States. The fewest amount of people go to any given religious institution on a given Friday, Saturday, or Sunday in the Bay Area of any place in the United States. So I had an experience of the kind of non-religiously affiliating or none of the above, you know, the nuns, as it were. And I did not grow up in a religious environment. But I would say for a lot of people around me, yes, there was a lot more religious identification. Again, it was primarily Christian identification. That's, you know, still about, even today, about 70% or 75% of the United States. But one of the things that's happening, I think, with emerging adults is all this transition is also setting up people sociologically not to affiliate with a religious tradition. So there's two parts to that. And I mean, there's at least two parts. One is what I hear from students when I do long interviews with them of an hour each. They'll tell me, my parents said to me, I don't want you to have to be forced into any one religion, which I think if it's the older part of this 20-something world, that would be – their parents would tend to be baby boomers. And they say, I don't want to force you to have any one religion. So they've learned to be really open, and they haven't had anything to affiliate with or go back to necessarily. So that's one thing. And then I think there's just that whole world of the sociology of not growing up in a church doesn't mean you go back to the church when you have a family. That has been traditionally the way that churches, particularly churches, but synagogues and mosques, et cetera, have done their work, as they say. You may have grown up in this, and you may leave and explore in your, you know, early adulthood, but you're going to come back because you want to have your kids baptized or whatever. Well, the longer you have, you know, a period in which you're not in church, or let's just say church for now, it's going to be a lot longer, a lot harder for you to ever come back. The longer you have this period of transition in your 20s, this emerging sense, not yet married or maybe never married, not with children or never having children, the less likely you are to follow the sociological trend of coming to a religious institution when you become, quote, a full adult, you know, an adult in the traditional sense of the word. So that makes the people I talk to much more open religiously and much more unidentified, which is this idea of people who are not religiously affiliating, who are spiritual but not religious. That's definitely an accelerating trend today. About 35% of my students, if you know the general demographics are correct, will, when asked what religion are you, won't check any box except for the box none of the above.
My guest is Greg Cuzzona, and he teaches emerging adults at Chico State University. He teaches classes in science and religion. But he also, if you tune in to North State Public Radio on Monday nights, Greg's is a familiar voice.
A familiar voice. Yes, I do a jazz show, which has really been fun. Yeah.
You've been doing that for quite a while now.
I think it's about almost 3 years. Yeah. Yeah. It came through somebody in the department, Bruce Grelli, who is also a jazz host, and he invited me to be part of this. So I've been a jazz musician since my early teens. And so it's really enjoyable to be.
What instrument do you play?
I'm a drummer. Yes. And I've had, thankfully, some wonderful opportunities to play. Primarily at this point in my life, a lot of my drumming is at home or in my head as I listen to good music.
Well, speaking of that, too, my family was not particularly religious, but I did have opportunities for music, as I recall now, when I was younger. If they needed a pianist in the Methodist church in a Sunday school class, I would play. There were pieces I could play. And so it was an opportunity for me to play music, which yeah. I no longer do. I would love to. I keep thinking, okay, I'm going to pick that up again. So thank you for being a jazz host here on North State Public
Radio.
It's
so fun to be a part of
Monday evenings
this.
At 9 o'clock. Might mention that.
I love that. Keep the promos going, yes.
But I do want to get back to this book that you wrote. And the title, again, is Negotiating Science and Religion in America, Past, Present, and Future. Why did you write this book?
This book is a book of scholarship. So I wanted to to contribute to the great scholarship that has gone on in terms of science and religion. And when I looked at this a few years back—
Because you published a book before this on science and Christian faith.
That's right.
You called it Mere Science and Christian Faith.
That's right. Yes, exactly. And then way back in, I think it was 2002, I published another book in a similar, you know, zone. So I wanted to do something that complemented the work that I'm doing right now as a scholar of religion, and as, particularly with a specialization in religion and science. And I thought to myself, what is an area where there hasn't been a tremendous amount of scholarship and research? And I recognized that the United States and the United States of America, which I'll come back to the America part in a little bit perhaps, but that the United States is a particular context for the way that science and religion have worked out. And that there had not been a book that really looked at the whole sweep of America as a context for these two incredibly important cultural forces. And I wanted to contribute to that. And, you know, this book is in the publishing world, it's 75,000 words. That doesn't mean a lot to most people, but it comes out around 200-some pages. So I'm saying that because obviously talking about science and religion in America needs many more books. So this is, I hope, a contribution, an opening bid, as it were, you know, in cards. The other thing that I think was, important for me to say, though, is that there are incredibly good books about components of science and religion. So Summer for the Gods by Edward Larson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book on the Scopes Monkey Trial, is just brilliant. And so I'm not saying there haven't been some sections, but as far as actually trying to get a sweep of how this has worked out, this relationship has been worked out and negotiated in our country, that has not really happened so far. And that's the reason I wanted to write it. I wanted to get a new space and make a new contribution.
It says on the cover of your book, this is the ideal volume for any student or scholar seeking to understand the relationship between religion and science in society today. And you do aim this at a little, you know, not a third grade level, but, you know, I enjoyed that. For example, you don't explain who, if you name somebody, you don't necessarily say who he was, or if you have a reference to Greek mythology. One that I enjoyed was Scylla and Charybdis.
Yeah.
Charybdis.
Yes, yes.
And,
From the Odyssey, yes.
And you don't explain who that is.
Yes.
So I thought, right on, Greg. I love that you challenge us to do some real thinking. And so thank you.
Well, I mean, Nancy, you're one of the kinds of person, you're the kind of person that this book would be written for, somebody who's really intellectually curious. I mean, you have an incredible intellectual curiosity and also intelligence. So that helps a lot. But I think a person who is just interested in the United States and the culture that we're in, and even some of the contemporary conflicts or discussions or, you know, collaborations, I think there's a lot here that would speak to them. But you're right. There's a kind of ease that comes when I mentioned Scylla and Charybdis, and I don't have to go into who that is, you know, or Francis Collins, who's the head of the National Institutes of Health, and I can just state who he is. That there's a certain ease in that, and in a book like this, it has a component that, as a person who's part of these conversations, I can get a little farther along in the intricacies of them by assuming some things.
My guest is Greg Cuzzona, author of Negotiating Science and Religion. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Greg Cuzzona, who is author of a new book, Negotiating Science and Religion in America. He's also a jazz host on Monday evenings here on North State Public Radio. Well, now, you have an interesting setup for your book. On the back of your book, you say science and religion represent two powerful forces that continue to influence the American cultural landscape. And you say that your book, this book you've just written, sketches an intellectual cultural history from the Puritans to the 21st century, focusing on the sometimes turbulent relationship between the two. So what you did in the part of your title of your book, besides Negotiating Science and Religion in America, is past, present, and future. So the past, you did a good bit of research on the past, yes, bringing us up to date. And, of course, the present, or you mentioned things that, well, yeah, that's true. It hadn't really, because these things that you're living through, you don't really realize what's going to be significant at the time. And then the future. Oh, okay. Let's go to the first part of these three tenses.
Yes.
That you examine, and where did you start in the past?
Yes. Well, and let me just say, at some point, well, I'll just sprinkle in, there's a first couple chapters on definitions and context and all that that may be relevant as we go through.
Yeah, because do we even know what we mean by science or religion?
Right. I mean, science is a little easier. It's the study of the natural world through observation, experimentation, and, you know, it's a sort of broad definition.
And I didn't realize it's a fairly new word. Even the word scientist,
right,
is relatively new.
Right.
Well, good grief.
So it wasn't until 1834 was actually placed into a vocabulary, but 1833 was coined by an English polymath who put this term together to describe people who are doing science. So before that, it was natural philosophy, the philosophy of the understanding of nature. And that shift in making a scientist a particular kind of person did change the way that the discussion happened, which, again, we'll leave that and give some examples later. Religion's much more complicated. And I would just say here, and we can go into it in detail if you want, but that religion and the way that scholars look at it is much closer to spirituality and allows for the things that we would call spiritual. Or, you know, when a person says, I'm spiritual but I'm not religious, that wouldn't necessarily be out of bounds for what scholars of religion call religion. In other words, if you take Houston Smith, the great teacher at UC Berkeley, he would say it's, you know, orienting yourself to an ultimate concern. That's what your religion is. And that allows for great breadth of religious practice. So, yeah, I mean, those two terms are really tricky. And then you put them together and it isn't, like I said, I think you read that part, it isn't just one thing between two different forces. It's a multiple set of forces that are talking about a number of issues and topics.
Well, to take one religion, Islam, which I don't – there are certain things that I think, I don't think I could go along with it. But the Sufis, I thought, boy, I could go for that.
Right, yeah.
And so even within one religion, in quotes, there can be such a spectrum.
Right, right. That's right. Absolutely. And, you know, you have 1.8 billion Muslims. You have 2.4 billion Christians. So every time I teach about Christianity, I'm putting quotes in the air when I say that, and Islam, I say, you know, these are billions of people we're talking about. I will, as a teacher, I'm just trying to give people grammar to help understand these traditions. But, you know, never go up to a Muslim and say, okay, I did my class with Greg, here's what you believe, right? Because there's a wide variety, you know, and I've been involved in the Christian church for a number of years now, and I can just tell you that within any one church, there's just a great variety of beliefs, orthodoxies, heresies, and all that sort of thing, as much as there's even different interpretations that are more official. So that's always saying, yes, absolutely, there's a great diversity. And if you don't mind, there's one other thing in here that I think is so important for grasping the past, from the past, something that has an implication for today and for the future, which is this ongoing component of the United States of individualism. So we tend to be a very individualistic country. We think of ourselves as individual.
Today, I think.
Today, yes.
I don't think that was true when I was growing up.
Mm, yeah.
In the 50s, you all wore your haircut the same way.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's good. Yeah, that's important. And I think that's increasing. But we do have these people within our history who have done all kinds of religious individualistic, you know, practices and not been the norm. You know, so even though we might think, wow, there's so much, especially Protestant Christianity in the history of our country from the Puritans forward. There's always been these alternative voices, you know, like Thoreau or, you know, in our own time, we think of, again, this whole trend of the nuns, you know, but also the offshoot religious groups.
Nuns, let me spell that.
Yes.
N-O-N-E-S.
Yes, exactly. The people who are not religiously affiliating. So that's been a part of our culture that is has been maybe a minority report, but that's certainly growing much more. And that was an interesting thing about looking at the past is you see, you know, how much this is a part of things. So with the Puritans, which is where I start, I look at Anne Hutchinson, who's a woman, which is really significant in this case because all the people who could interpret the texts of the Bible and so on were men. Here she's saying she's getting specific revelation to her through the Spirit. And that, in a way, it shows that there's this religious tradition which has a kind of uniformity to it, and yet there's always people that are experiencing something unique. In the end, of course, Anne Hutchinson was cast out of Puritan England and ended up, you know, in Maine, right? In Rhode Island. Thank you. Sorry. And then you have the people that were revived, as it were, in these great awakenings of the 1700s. And one of the things about our country that struck me was revivalism is such a part of our concept as a nation. So it does a couple things. And in terms of religious individualism, it says that your religious experience individually is the most important thing. And so that breaks down a lot of the religious structures that would have been much more there in other countries with especially a state religion. So that's one of the first things. It also means that in the United States, we tend to be given over to a past and a present. Like on this day, there's a before, and on this day, there's an after. And so that can become secularized. You know, we can say, well, I went to Burning Man, and before Burning Man, I was this, but after Burning Man, I took the 10 principles and lived them out in this way, right? Or I was really confused, and I went to a Buddhist retreat, and before I did this, but now I'm enlightened. I mean, we take this kind of revivalism in many different forms today, but it also means that the unit of measurement for our religious life is often the individual in the United States. And I think we've had a kind of, I don't know if it's a fight or conversation between the institution and the individual, and I think the individual is definitely rising in the contemporary era.
My guest is author and teacher at Chico State. His name is Greg Cuzzona, author of the book Negotiating Science and Religion in America, Past, Present, and Future. And you mentioned that you go back to 1687, and then you go forward to the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Yeah, so 1687 is the publication of Newton's Principia, which is famous for delineating
Sir Isaac Newton, am I?
Thank you. Yes, Sir Isaac Newton. And then the American Revolution is significant because of the marker that it is. So between Newton and say the mid 1700s, you have a pretty significant amount of authors and thinkers in our country that are Protestant Christian, especially the Puritans. And they're because they're the most educated people, they meaning often the pastors, like a Jonathan Edwards would be one of those people, but many, many others, they are commenting on science, what we call science and religion, or for them, back to this thing, it was natural philosophy, which could include God and nature and metaphysics and all that sort of thing. Around the
American— the word science and scientists had not been invented yet.
Right. I mean, science was used to mean knowledge, you know, from the Latin, so it would be the science of lots of things. But you're right. Like what we consider to be science was not invented, or a scientist specifically was not invented as a term. So then in the 1770s, you really see this rationalizing trend in our country. And we've tended to look at science and religion as reason and heart, you know, reason and emotion. So back to the revivalism in our country, that's tended to be a heart, you know, emotional side of human life. And so when you see a rise in rationalism with the Enlightenment in the 1770s around the founding of our country, there is a kind of anti-religious as far as the institutionally religious side. So Thomas Paine is one of the people I talk about in that period. And, you know, he is not against—
Even the title of what he wrote.
Yeah, right, right. Common sense.
Yeah. Common sense.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, if I were to ruffle some feathers? Ruffle some feathers. You know, the idea of a Christian America with the founding of our country and the Constitution, it's hard to sustain it. I mean, yes, the primary religion was Christian in this time, but so many of these people, like Washington, et cetera, Jefferson, were not at all Orthodox Christians, and many others were rationalists, like Paine. And so it's really interesting during this period of time we're seeing a rise of rationalism, which would be tied to what we would call science today or natural philosophy. And so there's a different relationship with religion. I mean, this is, of course, all pre-Darwin, which is so significant for this discussion with his publication of The Origin of Species in 1859. But at the same time, we're already seeing some trends that would be rationalizing and, you know, scientificizing or something. I just made up that term, but, more scientific, yeah.
So you take us up from and through the Puritans to the American Revolution and then up to 1859. And that year, I think most Americans, if you say 1859, they think, uh-oh, this is the Civil War is coming up.
Right, yes.
But there was something happening that we were so focused on what was happening here. Why was 1859 significant in your book?
Right. I mean, it is that publication of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species. And yet, as I note that, you know, like you just said, we were on the route to Civil War. So there's a kind of blunted impact of Darwin in the United States. So, you know, even though it's significant, there's a way in which you'd have to really talk about post-Civil War as another era in which we could really take in some of the changes in science. And I think I just want to insert right from the beginning that the presentation that's often made that evolution just turned upside down everything religious, especially everything Christian, is just not accurate. I mean, there were a variety of responses, and for some people, this was the crisis beyond crises. But it isn't true to say that was the rejection was the only response to Darwin's Origin of Species. There was actually quite a variety of reactions.
So you take us up to the Revolutionary period to 1859, and that was a demarcation from 1859 up until then. And then after 1859, Darwin on his book On the Origin of Species, and you just were saying that there was no one reaction.
Right, that's right.
And then you have another division in your chronology, 1870 to 1925, the rise of religious modernism and pluralism to the Scopes trial.
Right. Yes. So there's a lot of interesting things that are happening in that period. And one of the key things with modernism or liberalism is the desire to connect faith with what's being understood through modern life, modern science, modern thought. Like Shaler Matthews talks about this from the University of Chicago. That is modernism or liberalism, is let's update what we believe according to science, according to, again, stick with science. That's my topic. That also maps on to the progressive era, you know, the idea that we want to make things better in our country. In our country, there's a lot of optimism, not only optimism, but there's a lot of optimism in that time. And the reason I'm conscious of that because of this degree I mentioned earlier at Berkeley, and my undergrad was in French literature. And in the late 19th century, the mood in Europe was extremely dour and negative, and there's a lot of quite serious literature that doesn't really connect with what we're doing in the United States. So that's the one side, is this progressive era, this modernizing, liberalizing side. And a lot of it is reacting and responding to Darwinism. Now, the other side I probably should mention is the whole development of the fundamentalists in around 1910 or so. Let's just give that as the date, 1905. There's one of the famous articulations of fundamentalism is made. These five fundamental categories for what should be held by a Christian, by a Protestant Christian. And it isn't just a reaction to liberalism, but it is a lot of it, a great deal of it is a reaction to this liberalizing tendency to say, you know, I want good old-time religion. You know, I don't want this new stuff that's kind of fall, you know, seems flimsy. And so that's part of what's going on. In addition, and this is going to connect with a really important theme in the book that I discovered the importance of it as I went in, as I was doing the research, is you have this explosion of different cultures come in the United States, part of which is non-Protestant cultures, meaning Catholics, primarily not so much Eastern Orthodox. But you also have, of course, the immigration to our country, the encouraged immigration of especially Chinese laborers in this part of the country who bring Taoist, Buddhist, and Confucian concepts and religious practices. You bring this consciousness, which is embodied in the World Parliament of Religion during this period, of the fact that there are many religions in the world, not just Christianity, and people wanting to see in what ways those have truth to them or could be as true or alternatives to, you know, to belief in the Christian message. So there's this pluralizing that is happening as well. And partly I think fundamentalism, whether it's today or in that period, is a reaction to pluralism and a retelling of a story that we were always this Christian nation that believed X. I mean, we see that today also, right? So that's the story I'd usually tell. I mean, those are – as a person trying to just tell the story, I'm not trying to load it in with my own bias. But I will say that as I've read the history, I've tended to side with those people who want to integrate science and religion. I think they're better for our country. But the people who were doing that were bringing in scientific racism through eugenics right in that period. And that's the scary part.
It is scary.
A part of the story that has to be told.
Well, since you mentioned eugenics, we're kind of getting ahead, I think, of our chronology here. But that just leaves a bad taste in people's not always.
Yeah.
That's what was a little bit shocking.
Right.
That people didn't complain about what was going on. Maybe they didn't know.
Right.
But things our own government did.
Right. I mean, it's part of it is how long this period was.
Yes.
Right. So Francis Galton, the cousin of Darwin, I'm not blaming Darwin for Galton, but just an interesting connection, starts this idea of eugenics, which means good birth, right? How do we help ameliorate problems that we're seeing in these industrialized cultures like England, where he was from, or the United States? Well, we help the beneficial people to have more children and the people who are, you know, deleterious to the culture not have children. And so that's building in the 1870s, 80s, 90s. By the 20th century, there is official government sponsorship of eugenics practices. And this is being done Stanford, Harvard, Yale, Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories. It's being supported by the government foundations, the Kellogg Foundation. There's religious connections with all this. Even one of the heroes for liberal Christians, Walter Rauschenbusch, who came up with the social gospel, that the belief in Jesus is not just about people's individual souls, but about helping people's lives socially. He was a eugenicist. So it's really amazing.
Well, do you know, reading your book and considering how this period of time of eugenics made me a little, perhaps, more understanding of the way my dad proposed to my mother. His dad was a physician. He sees this attractive, talented young woman. And when he proposed to her, he did not say, oh, I love you, let's spend our life together. He said, I want you to be the mother of my children.
Mm, wow.
And I thought, boy, that's not romantic. But then reading your book, I thought, well, maybe that was part of the feeling in those days.
Yeah, that's a really striking illustration. I think it is. I think the idea was we're trying to help the culture as a whole through this. But of course, that was tied to some terrible racist rhetoric, and that really the best people were white Anglo-Saxon Northern European Protestants. So I'm one quarter Greek, Macedonian. That's what Kutsona is really, Kutsonis. When my grandfather came over in 1915, and I'm mentioning this as by way of illustration that I'm very light skinned. So everybody think, well, I'm Northern European, But when my grandfather came over, and specifically after the 1924 Immigration Act, he would have been seen as a non-white immigrant, you know, Southern European. He was Greek Orthodox, so not Protestant. So he wasn't even part of eugenics, good eugenics, right? Good birth. He would be seen as part of bad birth. Now, you just, you know, play that out to people who are much more identifiably seen as part of a different race. And, you know, if you have darker skin or whatever else would identify you in that way. And you can see how this plays out to be some pretty terrible things socially. And now it's connected, even sadly, more sadly, with people who were trying to bring their religious faith into conversation with the best of science. So I just want to say a couple things because this is such a fraught topic. Let me just say, on the one side, that science today really invalidates the idea, the biological idea of the three races I learned. And I'm just going to use the language that was I learned as a kid, which was Negroid, Caucasoid, and Mongoloid. Right? Those are the three races that were taught to me in public school in California, right? To identify those as significant categories biologically, I mean, let me emphasize that word, is not sustainable. In other words, there are what we would call phenotypic or you know, things that you can see in genetic expression that could identify people within certain categories, hair color, shape of the eyes or nose or whatever. But those aren't very deep. They don't really tell you about things like specifically about things like ethics. You know, that was what people were really trying to solve, is how do we have a more moral society. So that's one thing. Race does have a significant cultural element for sure, and that's significant to not get lost in this. But as far as a biological element, this connecting of race and science has really pretty much been dismantled, largely speaking. The second part of it, I think, is just to identify that, you know, our country was going through this argument whether we were going to really live out the intention of our early documents, that all within the language men, but really that meant within this language all people are created equal, or were we going to fall into the fact that women couldn't vote until 1920, I believe, and of course that people who were of African descent were enslaved, you know, and then everything happens after that for, you know, a huge period of our country. So we're trying to understand which of those angles we're going to negotiate. And what I think is interesting in this book is all that gets played out through these amazingly powerful forces of science and religion. And I think gives some depth to that conversation.
After a break, I'll be talking to author Greg Cuzzona about his new book, Negotiating Science and Religion. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with author Greg Cuzzona, who teaches at Chico State University in the Department of Comparative Religion and Humanities. His newest book is Negotiating Science and Religion in America, Past, Present, and Future. So I want to stay in the past for one more item, and that is the scopes. And there's usually an adjective in there before the word trial, and I heard it as the Scopes Monkey Trial.
That's right, yes.
And in reading your book, I realized, gosh, I didn't know that. It was really seemed a trumped-up issue.
Yes.
And The movie, they made a movie, which has been years since I saw it, Inherit the Wind.
Yes.
And that was not really an accurate depiction.
No, it was not. Yeah.
But I did, I was I was quite amused at what you included as a part of the trial that went on. So tell us who these characters were that took part in this.
Well, so there was this trumped-up trial, as you said, around John Scopes, who was a teacher who—
He was a substitute teacher.
Not even sure if he ever taught evolution. But it was teaching evolution in Tennessee, in Dayton, Tennessee, was against the Butler Act, which didn't allow people to teach evolution, essentially. This was during a period when public schools were becoming much more prominent. So, like in public schools always, there was fighting over what should be taught. So John Scopes is brought on trial. It becomes this huge national event. Two of the most famous people of the day are brought to the trial. There is, on the one side, William Jennings Bryan, candidate for president at one point, actually a pretty liberal politician, very committed Christian, who's on the side of the team to present the case against Scopes, right, to go against the teaching of evolution. Not, by the way, because of the age of the earth, but primarily because of the interpretation of the Bible and particularly the issue of were there historical people, Adam and Eve. And then you have Clarence Darrow on the defense, the most brilliant attorney of the day, who asks Brian to come on the stand, which is unbelievable. This
yes,
is allowed to happen.
That's shocking for the very fact that Brian agrees to take the stand.
Yes, yes. And as I understand it, if I'm not mistaken, they took it out of the courtroom and did this outside.
Oh, because it was so beastly hot.
It's beastly hot and so
Tennessee
many people.
Tennessee in July
yes.
can be miserably hot.
Yes, yes.
So I can see why they would go outside.
Yes, exactly. So I think we're going to do a little reading from the transcript of that. Is that right?
I would love to. Okay, so here we have these two attorneys. And Darrow is the one who has put William Jennings Bryan on the stand. And I'm going to let you, if you don't mind, start with the question. This is you reproduce the dialogue in your book. Start with when Darrow asks him what he thinks of the Bible.
Yeah, so I'm Darrow and you're Brian in this weird cross-examination that's happening. But what do you think that the Bible itself says? Don't you know how it was arrived at?
I never made that calculation.
A calculation from what?
I could not say.
From the generations of man?
I would not want to say that.
What do you think?
I do not think about things I don't think about.
Do you think about things you do think about?
Well, sometimes.
Oh, that's a great moment. I mean, and they're talking about how old is the age of the earth and the generations in the Bible. You know, they're trying to make this scientific approach to the Bible. And Brian, you know, who was a great orator, is caught in what this very crafty defense attorney can get him into. He's tied into knots. And in fact, I don't know if you want to say more about that.
Well, what was so shocking is I had forgotten what happened to William Jennings Bryant right after this.
Right, right, exactly. So he died within a few days after.
Yeah, 5 days later, William Jennings Bryant expires.
Yeah. Yes. And so that's a really interesting thing in and of itself, back to this fundamentalist modernist bit, is that the fundamentalists see Bryan as a hero after that. So he's not understood to have lost. He's understood to have defended the faith against this arch secularist. And even though fundamentalism kind of goes underground for a while until it basically reemerges in the 70s as a popular movement, the fundamentalists feel like they've gotten something in this moment, and they feel like they've defended the faith against the inroads and incursions of science. Let me also add, this is so important to what we were saying about eugenics, that the book used by George William Hunter, Civic Biology, that the text that Scopes was teaching was a clearly eugenicist text. I mean, definitely had passages that would state eugenics ideology. So in that way, there's a side of this, again, the good guys would for me be the people who are trying to bring these two cultural forces together. They are also bringing with it a support of a eugenicist text. So it's much more complicated, all this, than at least I'd like it to be. But for a book like this, that's great. People see complexity, they see nuance. It's really wonderful.
Well, there were a lot of things that surprised me. But you've been studying this so long, were there surprises in your research?
Well, I think the history of eugenics was a surprise. And I remember listening to a podcast on this on Fresh Air, another NPR program. And it was a wonderfully important podcast, but the term it was used was pseudoscience. And I agree that this isn't good science, but what I don't agree with is that makes it sound like it was some kind of sideshow. But for about 60 years in our country, it wasn't a sideshow. This was seen as good science. And one of the problems with eugenics historically is that it really only ended or the main reason it ended was because of Nazism. So it was almost more of an embarrassment than a sense that the scientists were abandoning it at a certain level. Now, today we have a lot more evidence of why eugenics, it doesn't really hold up scientifically, so that when Richard Dawkins makes a pro-eugenic statement a couple days ago, he's jumped on, right? But at that time, it was central to the work of science, and that's a surprise. That was a huge surprise. The depth of racism in our country.
Well, I think I was surprised too. I mean, I knew about the eugenics in the United States, but somehow I overlooked that because that's us. And I look at the Nazi Germany and think, gosh, those were bad guys because they practice eugenics. And that kind of brought me up to the, they were bad guys, but we weren't blameless ourselves.
No, we weren't. Right, we sterilized people who were seen as misfits or as immoral criminals. Thousands of people were sterilized during this period of time. We also, we're part of sharing information with the Nazis, for goodness sake. So we worked together with them. We are blameworthy in this.
My guest is Greg Cuzzona, and his newest book is Negotiating Science and Religion, Past, Present, and Future. So we're kind of getting up into the present, but Greg, can you see the future?
Well, nobody else can see it, but my crystal ball is right here. Okay. Yes, I mean, I will say in the present, just to set a little marker for the future, there's, three primary people that I identify in terms of representatives. So the representative of a conflict would be Richard Dawkins as a key voice. The representative of the independence model, Stephen Jay Gould, the late Stephen Jay Gould, who'd say there's two different ways of looking at things. And the representative of collaboration would be Francis Collins, as I mentioned. I don't think I mentioned earlier. Yes. Okay. So the head of the National Institutes of Health. Yes. So I think that's where we are in the present with these three groups. They represent sectors of our world today. You know, conflict or of our world of the United States, conflict, independence, or collaboration. So that's where we are in the present. The other part of the present, I think, that we're in is we're not in the kind of three-part breakdown that scholars talked about in the early 60s of Protestant, Catholic, and Jew. For one thing, obviously the emergence of Islam is incredibly significant for our country. But we also have had already back into the 1850s, as I was talking about, even late 1840s, but especially in the 1960s and beyond, the immigration of religions, other religions, Eastern religion, New Age religion, into our country as viable forces within our culture. Viable, by which I mean not viable only in the sense of they are making an impact. That's all I'm saying. It's more of a descriptive term. And so we're seeing a religious pluralism that's significant about the present. The three people I talk about are primarily still in the Judeo-Christian, Islamic, Western religion world, Collins being specifically Christian. But as we move forward, I think we're going to see more and more people who are bringing in other traditions. Already in the 70s, you have the Tao of Physics with Fritjof Capra connecting Eastern thought with quantum physics. So that, in my opinion, will be something that will, definitely continue.
In fact, I meant to look on my shelf and see if I still have that copy, because I know I did in past years.
Yes.
Well, the people you just mentioned are maybe information that is important for our future. You make the point in your book that when Disneyland was created, Tomorrowland was conceived of quite differently than the way tomorrow turned out.
That's right, so exactly.
They
yes.
had to redo Tomorrowland.
Yes, yes.
So you're a little hesitant to say, well, this is how it's going to be.
Well, I am, and I was careful not to position myself as a historian. It's not really a historian. I'm a what would maybe be called an intellectual historian at some level, a person who studies how ideas are going forward. But at the same time, I didn't want to go beyond what a history or social science can tell us. So with that in mind, I still said, I'm kind of a futurist at a certain level, just constitutionally. That's what I think about.
Well, I have one more question for you, Greg,
totally.
And that is, what do you want us to take away? When we read your book, what's the takeaway?
Yeah, so I think the takeaway for me is that there are these two cultural forces that are really powerfully related in our country. And we will do well as a country if we relate them in a beneficial way and negotiate them in a beneficial way. As far as the future, I think as our country becomes less and less religiously identified, we will probably see less conflict between religion and science. Conflict has not been the dominant mode, even though I think that's a very popular conception, but I think it will increasingly become less conflictual. And I think that's a really interesting thing to take away and to say, is that happening? And as we move from 2020 to 2025 or 2030, has that actually happened?
Yeah, I do think that was an interesting choice of the word negotiating in your title, negotiating science and religion.
Yes, yes. I mean, the thing about negotiating, it takes people who are skilled. And I think that's the – and actually the term was given to me by Dan Barnett, one of our philosophers here at Butte College. Yeah, so how do we negotiate those two? I think that's really fascinating to me. And what will that be about?
Well, there's so much in your book that we didn't have time to get around to, Greg. So I hope people who are interested in this will pick up a copy and get up to date on these things and review the things that you brought out today.
Well, I hope so, of course. Yeah. And they'll, if there's any way, of course, anyone wants to connect with me, you can always look at my blog. Just look at Greg Cootsona, C-O-O-T-S-O-N-A. And you can find lots of stuff that I've put out on these topics.
My guest has been Greg Cootsona. His newest book is Negotiating Science and Religion in America, Past, Present, and Future. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.